This is the Lean Into Art Cast. Whether it's illustration, cartooning, UI design, or presenting, it all comes down to telling your story, communicating your ideas. But it ain't for the faint of heart. But let's lean into it.
Because we're never ready, so we might as well just do it, right?
Either it's never ready or we are always ready.
That's the half full, half empty approach, right? So,
yeah.
So, Rob.
Yeah, Jersey. Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com. And
you do that just to make me feel bad that I don't say, hey, Rob Stenzinger of artgeekzoo.com, interactive-storyteller.com, Rob Stenzinger on the Twitters, Rob Stenzinger on Google Plus. You totally do that. That was passive aggression. No. You heard it here first, everybody.
Ooh, passive aggression. I do have a black belt in it, but I am from Minnesota and whatnot. And no, it's because that's part of the politeness of Minnesota is holding everything in so tightly that it comes out in various ways through tendrils of wicked emotion and vapors and stuff.
That's terrible.
No. Actually, I do that. It's playful. I'm playful and mischievous.
You're puckish. You're sprightly.
Sometimes.
Oh, man. Thanks, old man.
Well, for instance, I do really enjoy timing, trying to make someone laugh related to, they're going to cough or they may, you know, do a spit take. It's wonderful. It's
fun. I got the mug almost in my face.
I know.
So you said the other day that you wanted to make me mad more often.
Uh-huh.
You got something to make me mad?
See, I actually did prepare a variety of ideas, but making you mad, that's sort of a, it's a dance. I mean, and I'm not that Machiavellian in my planning. So I thought it was neat when it comes up naturally. When, let's see, you got frustrated with,
was this last episode we were talking about styles?
Last episode, styles. It was near the end. And do you remember what you got mad about?
No.
I
know what my hot button is. That's an easy one. I'm easy to play that way is get me cornered into an argument where there's a right way and a wrong way to do it. Right. It probably came out of something with like, oh, it's just not done. You just don't do that because the way to get me murderously angry is to be bureaucratic. The one time I ever lost my, like in my adult life where I ever really lost my cool in public, like really yelled at somebody, was when I was trying to argue with reason and I was trying to be cool about it. But they just kept giving me the same answer in different words over and over again. And it was clear that they were not interested in resolving the issue or debating it or even acknowledging that maybe I had a point. It was about get this guy out of here and just repeat the same thing again and again and again. And then I cracked. I completely cracked. When people don't behave like human beings, then I crack.
Painful.
And so, yeah, this is for everybody. You know, I'm not saying I'm special in this way. Everybody feels this way to some degree or another. But actually,
I would say some people who are always looking for, they're either trying to fight against the red tape and the bureaucracy, or they are looking for ways to up their kung fu to protect their bureaucracy. Mm. And so they do exchange recipes and whatnot. And so it's like, oh, yeah, well, if you ever get caught in my line, now I know what I'm going to do.
So, and then that trickles down to the arts where I get really flummoxed and irritated when somebody suggests something that is a definitive statement. And it's not that I think that art is this gooey thing that is nothing and everything at the same time. But when people say things like, if you haven't achieved X by this age, then you're done. Forget it. You'll never achieve anything with your work. That's the kind of stuff that gets my hackles raised. And that's the kind of stuff that gets me to like do a little bit of that soapboxing when I do a little homily on the subject. And you know what's funny is I never feel good after I do that. I always feel kind of ashamed of myself.
that's funny. If I, yeah, it's, yeah, acting out of, be out of anger, that's, that there's a bit of risk there. If I act out of anger, remain logical and focused and don't do anything to hurt others, I actually feel pretty awesome afterward.
Yeah, me too.
But yeah.
So like when people,
few
like,
ifs there.
Like in TV shows and movies and books and everything, when somebody like punches somebody and they're like, ooh, God, that felt good. I'm like, really? I never feel good after I make somebody feel bad, even if it's somebody I hate. And that's, yeah, maybe I'm a wimp, you know? I think that might be part of it. I think it, I'm a sissy. No, I am, Rob. I'm a big sissy.
No, I think you're, I'm going to say you're a badass, Jersey. You got to, you have to be weak to be strong kind of thing. I think it's good to know. Good to know your limits. Good to be sensitive to others.
Thanks for telling me that I'm handsome, Mom.
Insensitive and strength are two different things.
Oh, I don't know. I really don't know. And that's the premise of Lead Into Heart, is that we don't know, but we'll try to figure it out as best we can.
Oh, yeah. And I know I'll sound like supremely confident, like I've thought about something, I know, whatever. And I do this with my wife all the time, and I actually am willing to still question it. So for the most part.
So you had some thoughts about the latest lab for 30 classes in 30 days. We'd be, irresponsible if we didn't make at least some kind of reference to this event that we're holding while we're doing these podcasts.
Oh, yeah. So let's see. The lab that you did just a day ago was a super cool exercise where it's interesting with a lot of this. You know, so we just launched Lean Into Art. So I'm stepping back again before I get into the lab. Sure. Kind of describing the labs. We knew that we wanted to have a place where people could gather and live interact with us. We knew like this lab is a product that will be a helpful thing to the learning experience. But then as you know, the days went on throughout the month, I think we discovered a couple of agendas for labs where we've been doing a lot of interaction during the live classes. So that helps as far as getting the questions out. But then as the classes transpire, you see a pattern with things that we want the students to do, follow-up exercises, and you put yourself in their shoes as you see this building up. You think, oh gosh, this would be a helpful thing to talk about. And I think that's what you was sort of the premise of your lab that you came up with, which is this will help in the context of our learning experience for 30 classes in 30 days. You said it was, what was it? It was creating characters via,
it was creating a cast. That was
creating a cast. There you go. Which that's different than just thinking of individual characters.
Right.
And try to make them well-rounded.
Right. So giving them like the ostensible part was creating a cast of characters who all serve as debaters on your theme, right? They're all debating from a different position. And not debating as in like the movie Mind Walk, where it's people walking around and just talking for 2.5 hours while a violin just goes. I'm talking about through their behavior, through their life choices, through the interactions that they have and the responses that they give to situations. They're providing a viewpoint. I like to think about characters, and this comes out of my childhood, is with the cartoons that I enjoy, I always think that what makes a lot of children's entertainment really interesting is that the characters become options for you. Do you want to be this guy? Do you want to be that guy? Mm-hmm. Do you want to be her? You want to be more like her? You want to be more like him? And they're all providing you different life paths to go through and different ways to think about being an adult later on. And so I think that's kind of transposed onto my thinking about characters as being people who are arguing different points of view to the larger idea that you're either expressing through your story or you're using as a scaffolding to build your story around. Just my techniques, right? You know, that's not by any means any kind of like, oh, go buy my 12 books and 5 audio cassettes and come to my seminar and throw lots of money at me and then you'll be a great writer someday.
I think that's exactly what it should be. Please do attend Jersey's classes and buy a spot in his...
I see what you're saying. Yeah, okay.
Please do...
That's funny. I just kind of like said, don't sign up for Lean Into Art. Yeah, that was great.
I know.
Way to go, kid.
I'm mischievous. I'm like, I'm going to twist your words a little bit. But, hey, no one got hurt.
No, and, but what I was pointing at is that whole like kind of dependent relationship that a lot of experts or gurus try to foster. A guru, by definition, has a dependent relationship with the audience.
Yes.
But instead, I just propose thinking strategies that, and I make myself present to discuss them with people. So, okay. So, yeah. So, like, the exercise was, is I threw out, like, a whole bunch of, as you described them, emotional anchor points, right? Is that what it was? Like, I said, like, think of people from your past, and some specifically from childhood, some not, right? Like, one of them was, like, your best friend in fifth grade or whatever, your first romance. Some, in a general sense, somebody you just admired, somebody who you looked at and said, I want to be that person when I grow up. The someone you won't allow yourself to be, the opposite you who's your foe, and then the opposite you who's your friend, the friend who is like just polarized to you, but that makes them that much more compelling. And it's not to take these people and just put them in a lizard costume and now I've got a character, but to grab onto what was it about them specifically? What character aspects about them did you respond to emotionally? Because that's where, just like an old song or the smell of a certain kind of perfume, it's going to transport you back to that period, right? And like really put you in where you were emotionally.
Oh, sure. I mean, if you're going to tell a story relating to that and you have that emotional connection, it'll come through, right? I mean, so talking about, I mean, even the anecdote you shared as far as thinking about facing a person who's, you know, you've got a red tape chucking wizard who all of a sudden you know, you're not going to get what you needed to accomplish, like whatever, you know, I don't, who knows, getting your, I suppose DMV would be a common place where such red tape gets thrown. Anyway, I mean, you remember that very clearly. Maybe that is your, opposite sort of person. Yeah. And, But that emotion comes through when you start trying to tell a story and you're thinking of that.
Right. And then there's like a sort of an honesty to the narrative because you're speaking from like a place of, you know, like an intense emotion, you know, like, well, this goes back to when you're talking about getting me angry, getting me riled up. Right. It's entertaining to hear people talk about something they're really crazy about. Right.
It's entertaining. And it's also there's more. It's that honest expression, right, where I know that, I mean, I'm going to say there's a chance that, you know, listening to Jersey and I talk on things, I think we'll go to a lot of interesting places. But if he and I always avoid our emotions, it may not be that compelling unless you're really, you know, in your head with it. And there's something about emotions when you're broadcasting them. It's like it's a connection. We all have it. We have these emotions as part of our human experience to help us learn things and protect us and connect. Anyway, so they're powerful.
It emotions is powerful. And because of that, it should be used with a lot of integrity and caution, right? Because then there's people who turn it into a weapon. Like certain orators will use that kind of emotion to get people riled up and frothed up about things that they shouldn't be frothed up about.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's a dangerous thing too. And so I'm not saying that I necessarily have the intelligence to wield it as a weapon. But it's something that I'm careful of, that just because of the danger of that weapon, I try not to use it too often, just for fear of like setting off a bomb that I didn't intend, right? because I'm not smart enough to use it carefully, like a scalpel. I would just go, bleh, there's my emotions, and all of a sudden people are all angry at each other for some reason. Whoa, did I do that? Oh no. Anyway,
but it was super cool in that storytelling exercise where assembling as a cast, because many of our classes are focused on, we have character creation things going on. And then we have another set of classes that are focused on actually creating a short story, a mini comic. And this is like this really helpful glue in between that some of this territory is covered in other classes, but it's really handy, like a new perspective and reinforcement to help all of us going through 30 classes out to, you know, have a better shot at tackling those tasks.
The dangerous part was when I said to them, okay, let's pick randomly one of these different character types and I'm going to build a story right in front of you out of it. When I said that, I was like, we'll see if it's any good.
Oh man. And what's crazy, this, I didn't tell you this, but seriously, seeing that story come about, I don't mean to overplay it. I'm curious what it sounds like going back, but I'm just going to say raw how I felt. I'm like,
because you were there when it was happening. Yeah.
I actually can see how it'd be pretty awesome to collaborate with Jersey on a story specifically. Right. I mean, it wasn't just like, this is a commercial for Jersey's storytelling abilities, but like this is definitely flavored by him facilitating the exercise and it's valuable for anyone to repeat it. But actually I thought, wow, this is a pretty cool experience. And
I think
so even that it's like, that's an extra bonus where like people who are part of that live class got to collaborate, making a story with you.
That's that's what it was really about. It was a way to create a low risk means for people to brainstorm. Cause like when you say to students, you say, hey, tell me a story, give me an idea for a character. What does this character want? What do they fear? What are they going to do? How are they going to achieve that? Whatever they're trying to achieve. That's a lot to throw at somebody who isn't versed in this stuff, or even those of us who are versed, you know, it's tough. It's tough to like brainstorm that way. So this was me saying, this is very analogous to when I work with kids and I say, I'm going to hand over my drawing hand to your brains. You start throwing ideas at me. This is what we call the quick draw at Kids Read Comics. We do it every year. And I say, you start throwing ideas at me and I'm going to talk out loud about how I'm connecting these things as I draw the thing that I'm connecting. You know, as I'm building out of all your random ideas, they're a participant in the creative process because they gave me the initial the dinosaur architect and, you know, dragons and whatever. And I have to connect all these things. But they're a participant, but they don't have to deal with the panic of trying to tie it all together. Right.
Absolutely. It's you get to simplify the act of participating in it. It, for me, it reminds me a lot of the gameplay concept of, skill amplification. So for instance, if you play a game like Rock Band, you do not have to be able to play drums at the professional level. You don't have to be able to play guitar like, Dave Mustaine of Megadeth, right?
There we go.
For instance, right? Yeah. There's, I paid for the download pack for, Rust in Peace, right? And anyway, it's fun. You get to play at this different skill level gain experience with it.
Yep.
And what's cool with the storytelling is, I think you have a better shot of repeating it then.
Right, because they're getting to, I'm getting some slapback from you all of a sudden. I don't know what happened.
Let's try it now. I'm talking.
I'm still getting it. So weird.
Huh.
You're coming in loud and clear. You sound really good, but then all of a sudden, okay. Yeah, it's still doing it.
Still, I really turned it down, did I? That's weird.
That's nutty. Talking peewee is really cuckoo. Yeah, a little bit. And now it's gone. I think it was bouncing off of you.
Okay.
There we go. Much better. You got to get one of these dynamic mics.
I know. I made the investment in this silly monolith called the Yeti. And,
no, that's a great mic. It's just, unfortunately, it because it's omnidirectional to a certain degree. Right?
Yeah.
Little inside baseball for everybody talking about our mics.
Yeah, anyway, I do. And I have it on the setting where it's supposed to be less omnidirectional and focus forward. Anyway, if it's working now, cool. Let's move on.
So anyway, yeah, the whole thing was about like showing them that this can be done. All right. You can knit a story together just through simple word association. Let's demo it. Let's model the activity. That's a teaching term. You model the activity for the classroom so they can see how it works and do it in a way where they're interacting with it. So that they can go and do this themselves. But yeah, I didn't even think about that as an aspect, is that they also get to experience collaborating with a cartoonist who they may or may not like.
Oh yeah, that was a really fun aspect of it. And I have to say the story ended up being like the cast created this super interesting triangle of relationships that was a really cool story. So in a nutshell, it was the protagonist or the initial character that sort of ended up being the protagonist, because we didn't explicitly say that right away. It was based on the quote unquote opposite.
Right. Yeah. For the lead character, they were being a little devilish and said, well, let's base the lead character on your opposite foe, the person who you would never allow yourself to be because you find that person to be, you know, the antithesis of what you hold dear.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an interesting challenge because then it's like, how do I write that person compassionately? How do I write them so as not to turn it into a vaudevillian, put them up on the stage and let's throw tomatoes at them because we despise them, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can do that. That's an option. But I thought the more interesting place to go is how can we write this guy compassionately?
Yeah, certainly. There's more directions to go when you are empathizing with other perspectives.
Yeah.
It's more three-dimensional instead of two-dimensional.
Yep. And yeah, and I mean, I'm not going to say that we had an award-winning book written at the end of this thing, but we had a premise. We had the beginnings of what could be a really interesting non-genre graphic novel. You know, I mean, it didn't really feel like it was in any kind of particular genre.
No. So, yeah, I guess we could probably either choose to dive further into that or leave it at that. It was a really fun exercise. I mean, I feel like we teased it pretty hard to not say a little bit about what the story is, but.
Oh, go ahead. I mean, you could talk about it. And you know, I mean, I'm just thinking after doing that, that we should just turn it into a full-on class later on.
That, yeah, that definitely would be a great full-on class. And, or that's the other thing too, is with 30 classes, there's definitely, you know, future bundling things that we'll be figuring out because there's some great pairings and groupings of what we've created.
Definitely.
And, you know, with us and all the teachers and whatnot, so we're discovering things and interesting connections as we're going along. But with this, this could easily be a multiple week exercise or added to your current, multi-week, foundation of, comics foundation. It's comics. Not comics from the ground up. It's
comics fundamentals.
Comics fundamentals. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. So the story was it takes place in a mechanics garage, partially with the experience of the protagonist who is a overly emotional, not really in control of how they react to things kind of person. A bit, you know, sort of un. But were they? And they weren't that self-aware about it either.
No,
right?
No. Yeah. Art was on their sleeve. They were prone to violent temper tantrums and emotional outbursts.
Yet what this person was very attracted to the wise older mechanic that runs the place who is definitely very reserved and is so you had this tall, wilder character, this shorter, stockier, calm character that actually is a little bit impish and knows how to sort of play with emotions is very so doesn't it's is he's not like duplicitous or anything about it, but you know, so he's the kind of person who can handle a hot-headed customer in a way that sort of Jedi mind trick them to get them to just sort of get along with their day and either pay him and get out or, you know, just come back when their car's done kind of thing. Uh-huh. And the protagonist was, you know, always amazed by this or what have you. And then it turns out that the older character's daughter comes to visit
from overseas. She's traveled the world. She's had a rich background that has put her in a position where she is more centered and mature. But there was also a weakness to this that we discovered through just making associations in the discussions.
Yes, where I suppose she's, you know, the apple didn't fall that far from the tree, so to speak. She's definitely shares some similar traits to her father, but is still. She had this aspect where she was also out of her element as well. I'm trying to remember what that was. It was the.
She was having trouble expressing herself. Right. She was reserved to the point of she was cut off and aloof and emotionally kind of stunted as a result of that. So the old man, the old mechanic becomes the more balanced choice between these three particular paths. Right.
Right. And let's see. So basically with those personalities, you have the possibility of a sort of a, not like a traditional love triangle, but you have the new, not officially, sort of the younger guy who sort of adopted this other character as his father figure, and who is actually that the father of the girl who eventually the girl and the guy getting, you know, interested in one another as well. And anyway.
And then presents him with the option of going away from this small provincial place to broaden his horizons. But will he do that at the risk of jeopardizing his relationship with the old mechanic? And by making that, by crossing that final line, how is that going to affect the girl? How is that going to change her? What does she have to learn from this experience as well?
Mm-hmm.
There's a line she has to cross in order to get him to cross his line, right? So it started getting sophisticated very fast. That was the neat thing about it, you know?
Yeah. So there's just was a lot of richness to base a story off of with those personalities and the emotional anchor points to each of those personalities that we discussed. And that story could easily have, you could make it sort of, you know, light and romantic. You can make it more, you know, dramatic and soap operatic, or it could go on for, you know, a whole series of,
it could be a 20-volume manga. It could be a 2-hour film like Juno, right? You know, it could be a lot of different things, but you have a starting point. You have a place where you can start to build ideas out of. And the neat thing was, and I said it during the lab, is like, you know, 45 minutes ago, we had nothing. We had a list of people's names that, you know, kind of evoke an emotional response in us to some degree or another. And now we've got this. So that's the whole purpose of what that exercise was about.
Exactly. So very, very handy, worthwhile. And
well, thanks. I'm glad it worked out, because I wasn't, like I said before we recorded, that was the first time I ever did that particular lesson. And I got to give credit where credit's due. This was derived from a different lesson plan that I experienced in Mary Jo's class, my teaching friend. She did something similar to this with her students, and I had the privilege of sitting in and watching it come together. And so I made a little mental note that's good how she's grabbing those emotional anchor points by getting people to look into their own past. I'm going to use that at some point or another. And so I did.
Super cool exercise. So would you say that you were comparing your teaching with?
Oh, hi-yah.
Sorry, everyone. That was a segue. That was a segue, and I nailed a natural one, but instead of actually making it smooth, I chose to be a clown about it.
Well, and I didn't help with my, you know, my Ricky Lake audience response to it.
So, yeah, that's the other thing we wanted to talk about today is sort of creative comparison, comparing ourselves against the work and whatever as far as other artists. And
comparing ourselves to others. Comparing our careers to others, comparing our work to other people's works. And is this a good or a bad thing?
Mm-hmm.
People say, don't compare yourself to anybody. You are who you are. Right. And it just, that advice just works. Just makes you feel better. And you go through your life feeling.
I know. It helped a lot. Elementary school, cutting out snowflakes, hanging them on the wall, and under the banner of everyone is a snowflake.
Did that set
me up for life.
Wow. So you've never struggled with this since.
Nope. So how are we going to handle this?
You don't look at the social media's different streams and see people posting those little things like, I did a cool thing today. Look at the cool thing I did. And you don't go, oh, I wish I did that cool thing.
I'm totally joking. I compare myself to lots of people all the time. So.
And you're still here to show that, you know, that you can move on through life doing that. So it must not be that bad a thing to do.
I don't think it's, I think there's a lot of ways to go about it. So it's like, well, let's start with what do we mean by comparing?
Let's define.
Like,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do we mean? I don't know. This came out of some conversations I've been having with people about its negative aspects, its negative impact, where having drinks with some friends, and the topic came up of why they don't spend a lot of time on Twitter or Facebook is that for them, it's frustrating to watch everybody act as a cheerleader for their own life. And I said, so what's so bad about that? Because I'm one of those dudes who does that. You know, look at the thing I did today, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And this person said that, you know, it's like, A, they know that a lot of it, they suspect a lot of it is self-hype. And B, it's it gets frustrating because it's too often like, I wish I was doing cool stuff too. And I don't feel like I can cheer about my life every day that way. And to be, they felt put upon by the constant barrage of people cheering about their own lives. And when I say cheer about your own life, I mean regardless of your personality type. There's people who do it in a gloomy way. Look at the thing I did. Life sucks. And I expressed that idea in a song.
It was not nowhere as good as I wanted it to be.
Right. But there's still...
And I mean to say, dude, you smile way too much, Jersey.
Do I?
Yeah, no. I was presenting a false, you know, oh, you smile so much. I'd see, you ruined... I was going to play that up a bit. Your smiling makes me sad.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not smiling.
Me behaving the way I behave. Oh, I mean, this goes back to like when I've like exaggerated the amount of hate mail that I get, which I don't get that much hate mail because I'm not famous. Once I'm famous, I suspect that it is a cultural norm to just yell at people who are famous. I think that that is a truth now. I think it's something where society has evolved. You know, in the old days, it was throwing cabbages at the person on the, you know, in the stocks. But nowadays it's if anybody who achieves any kind of notoriety or success or acclaim or fame, people just line up to yell at them. And I'm ready for that if that day ever comes. But anyway, that was a segue. There's a side issue, rabbit hole kind of thing. where was I going? Sometimes I feel like when the people do complain about something that they intentionally downloaded from me, they went to my site on purpose and saw this thing from me and then yelled at me about doing it. It's like, should I just not interact online then? Because my presence alone has infuriated you, sir. I'm sorry. I'll go back to my house and I will not engage in anything anymore because by just sharing the thing that I think is neat and going, isn't this neat? It somehow triggered something in you to make you angry, right? Mm-hmm. My smiles make you sad. Yeah, that is a little bit of a weak argument about it. And it does speak to, it leads me to, and this is where I'm interested. I'm interested in the psychology behind this. What's going on in people's heads when they get bogged down by comparisons? Because this person who's feeling beleaguered by something like Twitter, my response was, just don't listen to it. Yeah, my stream is an endless parade of people going, look at the thing I did, and I wait for one to catch my eye. And then the other ones just become sort of like a background noise that I just don't really attend to all that much. But at the same time, I do that every once in a while. When I see somebody do something really cool, I'm like, oh, I kind of wish I did that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there was actually, there's an example, and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the name. I want to say for some reason, let's see if my memory's working here, was it Bendis who produced some comic that caused you to set down the brush for a few days?
It was Derek Kirk Kim. Derek Kirk Kim, same Kirk. Difference. It affected me so viscerally that I really went through a deep existential crisis about that. And, you know, I said, I don't know if I have the right to participate in this medium anymore. Mm. I was really, really emotionally upset by that book because it was so well done. And what's funny is it's a story that I normally would never, ever gravitate towards. It's like two sad kids walking around Pacifica, California, wondering about whether or not they made the right choices in their lives. That's the story. Wow. And it's like if you would have told me that, I'd be like, oh, I don't want to go see some, you know, Cannes Film Festival 2-hour movie about sad Canadian kids walking around. God, no. I don't care how many laurels are on the cover. If it doesn't have, you know, some kind of like, if it doesn't have a joke, if it doesn't have some kind of action element, I'm really not that interested. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, so like that's also why it shook me, because I was so engaged and so involved in this book that was also a genre or a type of story that I normally would hate. It really, yeah, that guy shook me apart. And then I found out he was younger than me, and then I met him at a convention, and he was a really sweet guy and really good looking. Just like, forget it. What's the point?
Well, so how did that happen then? I mean, so normally you're swimming in a sea of all of this stuff. I mean, you know, social networking, whatever, right? I mean, you probably have podcasts and whatever. I mean, tons of information that you're floating in that like demonstrate. Like some of these people are producing things that you probably feel great about. Some of them you're ignoring, some of them whatever. Like what happens with those two different situations that's different? Was it just sort of a temporary condition?
You're trying to use me as the case study?
I just did
how
it.
I got from a place of doing like some really severe comparisons between me and other people, and then to where I can get by now without doing that.
Or is it still a thing, or does it come up some?
It comes up sometimes, all the time. You know, all the time, all the time. I look at something that somebody did that I think is really, really neat, and I'm like, gosh, I need to do that. You know, I can't remember what it was, but I read an article recently about somebody in webcomics who was doing something that was really working for them. And I went through about a 10-minute cycle of how do I do that? How do I get that involved in my publishing career somehow? Well, I need to do that because they did that and it worked. And then the next thing is, thankfully, there's a voice in there that went, dude, that's how they did it. That's not how you need to do it. You just need to focus on doing the thing that makes you crazy, that makes you happy, that makes you spiritually mad. And you'll figure out the other parts. It's okay. There's not a deadline on this thing. And I think that's part of the psychology there, is that it feels like there's a deadline to these thresholds that you have to achieve. And if you see somebody like, okay, I don't know how many gentle listeners out there have experienced this, but I'm sure at least some of us have. You're 10 years old, and then all of a sudden on Star Search or on one of those stupid talent finding shows, which I think are just reprehensible. They get some kind of child prodigy on who does something. They can sing amazingly or play the piano amazingly, or they do something like that at an adult skill set level at the age of 10 or 11. And then mom turns to you and says, why aren't you doing that? You know, and then you feel terrible because like, oh, I'm only 11 and all of my opportunities have dried up because that guy did it first. That kid did it first. And now there's no, I don't get to do it because he set the standard, right? He achieved it before I got a chance to achieve it. And it suggests this sort of schedule to the whole thing that time's running out. And you know what? Time is running out. But this is I hope this doesn't sound fatalistic, but there's always tomorrow. And if there's not tomorrow, if I'm going to die tomorrow, I'll be dead anyway and I won't care. And I don't mean to say, let take your hands off the wheel, no point in steering now. But it's something I try to remind myself that there's no deadline on this thing. Anything can happen as long as I'm doing the work that is interesting to me and driving me spiritually crazy. Maybe spiritually crazy is a bad word to use, but I just mean like that gets me, that justifies my existence here, right? That if you took away everything in my life, you took away my house, you took away my wife, took away my cats, I would still have this thing that justifies why I should still be drawing breath, right? That's what I'm talking about. Is it that for me? Then the other parts don't matter, or they'll come into play, or they'll fall into place somehow. And when I say fall into place, I don't mean that it's just going to be gifted to me. I mean that I'll see the opportunities when they arrive, and I'll find my own path to this thing. I think that that's probably point one that I would point at, is when like people get bogged down by comparisons, is that they think that their life should be on the same schedule as other people's lives, which is kind of a false thing we put upon ourselves, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it seems like there's an assumption of a scarcity of the availability of the opportunity, and of also perhaps time to get to the opportunity.
There's only so much fame. There's only so much fame.
Yeah. Well, fame isn't like a, I guess we can use that word, right? Assuming fame is what we're going for, right?
Yeah,
I guess.
Right. Yeah.
Let's go ahead and use that word. But let's say, is fame like a city or something where there's only so much land and it's all been bought up?
This is what happened during that discussion over drinks. Is I started getting mad, and I said, "Yeah, you know, this idea that some people get to do the thing and some people don't, and that some people get to be the professionals and then other people don't." I said, "Wasn't the internet supposed to cure us of all that? Wasn't the internet supposed to be the great liberator that equalized everybody so everybody can do it if they want to?" And the counter argument I got was, no, that's just the problem. Because the internet's allowed everybody to do it, now everybody's screaming about how they're doing it. And that's what is frustrating to me and gets me to feel like I'm not doing enough, because now it's 100 million people all doing it, all screaming about how they're having a good time doing it. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not achieving that level of self-satisfaction out of it, then I'm doing it wrong. And I have a whole chorus of people yelling at me, implying through their own self-cheers that I am doing it wrong. I'm not saying I agree with this person's viewpoint. I'm just saying it's an interesting viewpoint. It is interesting that they had enough self-honesty to express this idea that way, right? Because I think a lot of us would deny that. And I think the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, that is kind of what's going on in my head when I see somebody doing it right and doing it well, is I want to be the guy who's going, nice job, you did it. But there's also a little part of me who's like, oh, God, fratting.
It's what's funny is I can totally identify with that, too. I'm not impervious to that at all. One of the my Achilles heel is when I see a child prodigy guitarist.
Okay.
And it rips my soul out where I'm like, I'm so happy for them. And I feel like an utter failure at the same time.
You didn't do it on schedule.
Yeah. I don't possess the discipline of a small child. And I feel like I'm a fairly disciplined dude, and I'm like, wow, I'm really whiffing it somehow. But at the same time, I mean, I don't get stuck there or whatever, but I do feel that I do for a time.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, it comes out of a sense of we want to be, I think, well, I can't speak for humanity, but I can speak for myself.
I can, I'm a human.
I think it comes out of a sense of you want to feel like you have some kind of sense of mastery over your stuff, over the stuff that you like, that you care about doing, right? And when you see somebody who is much, much, much younger than you, who normally does not demonstrate that level of mastery, demonstrate an equal or superior mastery over what it is that you want to be good at, then it's frightening. It's like when the son can beat up the father, that day when that relationship shifts, right? And we don't want to acknowledge that. We don't want to acknowledge that there's going to be a point at which we probably won't be able to do it any better than that because of whatever physical limitations we have or whatever. You know, my eyes are going. I can't draw as well anymore because my eyes are going. That's a terrifying thing.
I think it's that terror. Maybe that's like at the heart of like why I like to study a lot of different things, because I get to relearn that is really dumb a lot. And
strong words from a strong man.
You just said I know, dumb. Whatever. I'm putting it in a very crass or lame fat way, but it's one of those things where, okay. So for instance, it's been a few years and I'm looking to get back into it, but I spent a few years studying martial arts, and being younger than my instructors, I would, and actually different people's physicalities and whatnot, you have different natural things that you discover you didn't even have a vocabulary for. It's one of the things where I realized it was such an intense immersive learning environment. There was so much information that it had nothing to do with reading and programming or drawing or doing anything like that. But it's just, you are floating in information when you are sparring with a black belt. And to you, they are not floating in much information. And they have it fully abstracted, and they see you as a dancing, flopping pile of targets.
Yeah.
And that's what I realize, is that so as I go through different stages in life, I can use other aspects of my humanity to get the same things done. And what I get to label them at is whatever, right? So like maybe for a black belt, they don't feel it's like a win for them to just knock you flat on your butt, because they could do it really easily, right? So they're looking for some kind of quality. They have different definitions. So because they've developed so many different strengths and whatnot, they're experienced, they're older, but they're not as flexible. They're making all these trade-offs because of what they've learned, and they can apply it like that. But then again, I think we can experience that in pretty much any medium.
Right. I think so too. And yeah, I've sparred with a black belt before when I was taking some martial arts back in my 20s. And it was absolutely terrifying, because he was being very sweet and he was trying to teach me. But every time I would throw my fist out, he vanished and he was behind me, and my leg was all twisted up and it hurt. That kind of dichotomy is a weird environment to be in, where they're being like really sweet and patient with you, but they're hurting you, and they're also acting like some kind of like supernatural creature.
It's wonderful though. It's like, it's anyway, it's fun. Obviously, there's some difficult things and physical pain involved or whatnot, but just on a pure learning experience. And if you get any endorphins or excitement from that learning, it's a high. It's amazing. In the detail and the volume.
Are you, when you go back to martial arts, what happens if the sensei is younger than you?
I've already experienced that too. Because we had a parent school that had, I had the honor of watching, two different black belts, two different third degree black belts that were actually women of smaller build than me, by a long shot, do amazing things.
Yeah.
Unassuming Minnesota housewife. Yeah, you betcha.
Yeah.
Just taking out people and busting boards and bricks. And like, I'm like, my God, this is amazing. And so I experienced the older thing, but one of their like instructors was a gentleman who had just, you know, turned like 18 or 20 or something. And I was in my, you know, I was about probably 32. So, yeah. And and was neat because I think there's so many different dynamics in that experience where first it was a surprise because he's the first instructor that I had that was younger than me, but he still was of the ability to just, let's see, of the experience where he was able to share and demonstrate his abilities in an instructorly.
Well, that's where I wanted to go. Fashion. That's the difference. The difference is in that environment, he's not competing with you. He's there to help you.
Right.
And he's going to, especially in like a really focused discipline like martial arts, there's no room for people there's a little room for people to be like the bad dojo instructor from Karate True. Kid, right? You know, the Cobra, was it the Cobra Khan?
Cobra Kai, yeah.
Cobra Kai.
Pain does not exist and this dojo does it. No, sensei.
Yeah, there's a...
Et cetera.
But your odds are pretty much in favor of meeting somebody who is really, honestly wants to genuinely help you in a useful and instructive manner rather than just like beat discipline into you, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now let's transpose this on to the outside world in the creative arts. Suddenly I meet this 18-year-old kid who is far superior to me in skill, is achieving more things in their career, right? Like they're doing some like breakout hit. It's a big viral sensation. Everybody's posting fan art on Tumblr, you know, animated GIFs of their characters. Everybody loves this person. And then, you know, it's not a situation where they're there to necessarily help me. They're almost in a sense competing with me. We're fighting for the same space, are we not?
But are we? It feels like that, and that's where I think where I enter the transition of like a specific example. So about a year and a half, I could be fuzzy as far as the exact timing of this. But about when I think I felt like I was getting my sea legs regarding Arctic Zoo. And of course, I'm still developing and evolving, right? Don't mean to be whatever as far as that. But there was this comic called Axe Cop that just came out of nowhere and was like, guess what? Guess who's the most popular web comic? More or less. I mean, went from total obscurity to sensation. And I mean, heck, had crossover with eventually with Dr. McNinja.
Yep.
And I just was shocked at this sudden, you know, meteoric rise. And I thought, well, I think maybe I'm doing this all wrong because, you know, they've got this other approach. And I've been doing it long enough where I can see and sort of deconstruct that approach that they're using and then start comparing myself and wondering, well, should I be doing that?
Yeah.
Or darn it, why didn't I think of that? Or whatever. And you know, and also, will there be time for me to achieve something like that? And, you know, yeah, absolutely. It's some of the scarcity thing all at the same time.
The scarcity is the lifespan thing, right? We're always running out of time, right? That's only scarcity in the issue here. But then, yeah, we also map this on to a scarcity of there's only so much success to go around, right?
Right.
And then also there's only so much respect to go around, right? Like, yep. there's this echelon, there's this layer where only the privileged get to go, where the rarefied air is. And, you know, you only have so many opportunities to get in, right? Before it's too late. And also there's certain secret recipes that exist out there that only the privileged few will find. They'll find this secret box in the woods and they open it up and this is the recipe. Put it on your website. Okay, I put it on my website. Oh, you got a million viewers. You did it. You used the secret recipe. And now everybody else looking at what did they do? What was their recipe? Oh, I should do that on my comic or my art or my whatever in order to get an audience and get acclaim with my thing, right?
Well, jumping over to the psychology aspect of it, yeah, obviously just working on getting better at certain creative pursuits over the years and whatnot, and wondering, you know, how do you get better? How do you learn and whatever? Let's see. There's sort of a, if through that questioning, you know, like you, what's, I don't know. This is hard to both phrase as an example and deconstruct at the same time. Cause I also don't just want to go blah, blah, blah. Here's what I did. But I think what allowed me to get a foothold and a grip to have a fresh perspective on the situation was just an underlying realization that I know that there's different human weaknesses going on here, like in people in general and in me, right? Where like assumption of these magical solutions, like get rich quick and whatever. When people are dealing with big numbers, we're not good at that. We're flat out terrible at it overall. We need serious math disciplines and computers and whatnot to reliably crunch numbers. And even then, how you go about it, you still can have pretty poor conclusions if you're not being incredibly careful and scientific and disciplined throughout the whole thing. So we're not good at that. So we like to see when we can't dissect the magic, massive, wild, hard to imagine numbers of all these people on this interconnected worldwide network that somehow many of them flock to this thing, it's easy to start to think, well, there's a magic, there's a thing there that is like a trick I heard about that someone was really convincing before that, you know, we want to believe that because in some ways, let's see. So I read a paper a few years back. Now I'm jagging a little bit, but I loved it. It was something that helped me understand about something about gameplay. And I think it was written by Rafe Koster, and it was like, Games Are Math, I think is the title of it. And it had the theory that essentially one of the cool, compelling things about games is when they sort of orchestrate randomality and present it to us in an interesting way, because randomality is one of the only kinds of magic we have, if not the only thing, where I hadn't done follow-up research on this, but the paper points to how cultures past would use games similar to Parcheesi to try to pick which of the priests or what have you is feeling favor with the gods, right? Huh. Because the dice in the game is going their way. And it was essentially a way to detect divine intervention and some magic that whoever has the touch that day gets to sort of, you know, well, clearly they should be the one to give the speech, right? Because you got the touch. Wow. And obviously, and games do that with us, with our Vegas plays with our abilities to detect patterns and how poorly, you know, we do that, right? With pulling the arm on a slot machine. I've got a few things working against me, both the reinforcement psychology of, wow, this is really pleasant. Every single thing I do to touch this thing is so warm and comforting. It may as well almost be my own child, right? And it's telling me like I'm cute and pleasant and this is wonderful and occasionally rewarding the heck out of me or just a little bit, just enough where I can't detect what's going on. And I stay in the feedback loop. Anyway, I think those same traits lend us to be when we're not aware of it, we're in a pretty weak position to judge those big successes for that alone. And also because, well, we also didn't observe, like, chances are maybe Axe Cop, maybe that was a decade long project.
No. That's the other part. That's the part that people often forget, because, and this came in that discussion I had with those friends, is everybody likes to, you go to a news agency and say, here's two stories. First one, guy cranks and cranks for 15 years in absolute obscurity. A few opportunities present themselves, and he jumps on those opportunities, makes a few successive leaps in his career, gets into some better places, and now he finds himself living comfortably and achieving some level of prestige and notoriety. Or this guy came out of nowhere, never picked up a pen in his life, just threw down a few scribbles on paper, captured the world's imagination. The people are going insane over this breakout overnight success. Which one do you want to do this, write and put in the newspaper? Well, what do you think they're going to put in the newspaper, right? Which one is the quote-unquote sexy headline? Mm-hmm. Nobody likes to tell... Movies. Movies do this all the freaking time. Mm-hmm. Let's do the scene where the people are training really hard and practicing a lot of stuff. Let's make it a five-minute music montage. We'll just show a couple clips of them training really hard with some really peppy music that'll keep us interested, so we don't get bored in the fact that they're grinding. They're grinding through building their skill set. That's not an interesting story to tell unless you are a practitioner, right? And even then, it's not all that interesting to a lot of practitioners.
Yeah. Well, you're a little mad. Montage scenes are a... I think I was pretty addicted to movies that had good montage scenes growing up.
Oh, there's an art to it. There's an art to it, for sure. I'm not saying that the montage is a bad thing. I'm saying that it is a functional thing as well as an artful thing, right?
Totally. And they're abstracting away how much work it actually took to get to that position. And, you know, whether or not they're showing like, wow, seasons have passed before this is coming about. But for the viewer, it was not, you know, they didn't have to sit through summer and, you know, fall and winter. They had to sit a couple minutes, but and listen to a snappy tune. But
like the closest thing I've ever seen that I can recall off the top of my head where they actually like kind of did an okay job of expressing how tedious grinding is, is in the first Karate Kid again, where he has to sand the floor, paint the fence, paint the house. And they didn't do music montages, but they didn't like make you sit there with Daniel LaRusso while he's painting the house for 12 hours or whatever. But they showed the agony of it in his frustration that he didn't feel like this was going anywhere. You know, that they showed that part, and then they did the trick with show me sand the floor. Show! And then he does the thing.
Love that movie. And you're right. They really did. They abstracted it, but they put a different metaphor on it. They said, this is a chore. These are chores. And you're lost in the chore and you don't know what benefits coming out of it. Cause you're in the midst of it all, until you step back and you are able to be tested and, demonstrate.
That's a nice way of summarizing what that scene was all about. Yeah.
With Zamfir and his awesome flute playing as well, too.
So I'm taking it you didn't care for the Jackie Chan version?
I haven't seen it yet. It's on my list. I haven't seen it. I love Jackie Chan.
I love him too, but he's great in the movie, but I don't feel like they did as good a job with the abstraction.
It didn't have the same soul. Probably more convincing martial arts, but less convincing heart.
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah. I mean, it was Jackie Chan brought a lot to it because he's great, but
cool.
But anyway, the side thing. But yeah, I mean, so that's something that a thinking process that I've tried to turn into a habit in my life is when I see somebody doing something great, I try to remind myself that they probably worked really freaking hard at it. This is a sense of I'll admit to this. This is a sense of compassion that I've only recently come into in my adult life. When I was a teenager, I didn't have it. And teenagers don't have it. I mean, for the most part, like Rebecca Black, Friday, that song. If her name gets mentioned in any of my teen classrooms, everybody talks about, can we do a comic about her getting run over by a truck? And I say to them, you do know she's a kid like you guys. And she was just trying her best to do something, you know, and it's not her fault that it became this overnight sensation and everybody's talking about her. You know, think about it. Does she really deserve that much loathing and hatred? Well, then I get booed, you know, because, oh, you're trying to be a sweet, sensitive old man now when we're just trying to have fun with throwing sticks and stones at somebody who we, you know, revile. So, you know, when I was a kid, I did a lot of this kind of self-comparison and ending it with, well, I could do it that way if I wanted to sell out, or if I wanted to be a jerk, I could do it that way, you know, justifying why I'm not doing it as well as somebody else. But then in my 20s and early 30s, maybe, I don't know when this switchover happened, but it was a lot of that kind of anxiety of, oh God, I'm a hack. I'm no good. I'm 26 and I haven't achieved this yet. And this guy's already doing it and he's 25. How dare I even pick up a pencil? I have no right to be here on this earth. You know, I'm talking myself out of the room. Nowadays, there'll be a flash of that feeling like, oh, I wish I would have done that. But then it'll quickly turn to, but you know what? Everybody in this business is just doing their level best, you know, and if they get somewhere with it, good for them, for crying out loud. And I hope that people will be that nice to me if I achieve any kind of acclaim. And I hope I don't get the sticks thrown at me because everybody's sick of hearing my name, you know. But anyway.
Yeah, to me, it's like that's where I end up shifting. It's they're demonstrating it's possible. And this is going to sound, you know, fruity and whatever. You can go, haha, Zen master mode, whatever. But they're my teacher.
Yeah.
And I get to choose that.
Yeah. Well, I think this may be something that only came out of the fact that I started teaching and started really having to get more explicit about my philosophies in art and everything, and because I had to communicate it to children, which made me more thoughtful about it, which started a feedback loop, as you would say, right, to, you know, make me more mindful and learn more. And there was that experience where I was talking with a 15-year-old student he was telling me about this Blender program, this free 3D rendering software that he really enjoys. And he's telling me about how it works and he's really trying to sell me on why I should use it. And somebody who was present, another adult in the room, said, who's teaching who here? And I turned to them and was like, this is the way it's supposed to work. You know, I learned as much from them as they learned from me. I think that helped condition me to not get so defensive when I see people at different life levels or different like stages of life achieving great things, because it's an opportunity for me to learn from their vantage point. I think it's more dangerous to be dismissive of different age groups, right? Like, so like for instance, at SPX, I wound up hanging out with Casey Van Heist, Jonathan Griffiths, Ashley Quigg, and a whole bunch of other people. Honey, I don't remember how to pronounce her last name. Maybe I can link to him later. Honey Brosh, I think. Had a great time with these people. They're all 25, 10 years younger than me, you know? Now, my choices were, I could feel like, am I a loser because I have to hang out with kids after all at this convention? Or am I going to feel like, am I superior? Like, I've got a lot to teach these kids. These kids, they talk a lot about video games and like all those idiot kids from their generation. And I'm going to teach them what's really important. You know that Mario is cool, but you know what's really cool? The stuff I grew up on, because I grew up in the right decade. You didn't, you know?
Is that really what we're all doing? It's like, this is another territory thing. You know, it's time was a territory. And so it's like, that was the valid one.
And it's like, yeah, I talk a lot about 80s cartoons. I talk a lot about them and I really have a lot of affinity for that time period. Why do I have an affinity for that time period? Because that's when I was 8 years old. That's where a lot of my primary memories were being formed, was in that time period. That's where I was figuring out that the world's a big place and I get to make an imprint on it. That's an exciting time. Of course, I'm going to have fond memories for that time, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to say that, oh, these new cartoons, these video games.
There's people going through the same kinds of human experience right now with the same kinds of market complexities and whatever to get projects approved and produced and whatever, that some of them make it through the gauntlet. And I bet there's at least the same amount of good stuff coming out now.
Absolutely. And if you pay attention, it is, you know, it's like here's where I'm going to say something really stupid that everybody's going to hate me for. High School Musical was actually good. It was actually a reasonably solid story. If you consider the audience it was intended for, don't hold it up to Tolstoy. Don't hold it up to whatever Canadian drama about kids walking around sad with a bunch of laurels at the top that got all sorts of acclaim at the Cannes Film Festival. Don't compare it to that. Compare it to who was it intended to speak to? It was intended to speak to kids going through these kinds of things, and the characters are all vibrant. The characters come across. The plot is solid. It's good. I stay on top of this stuff, A, because I enjoy this stuff, B, because I work with kids, and it's important for me to be able to speak their language. If I can refer to, hey, this character's kind of like Sharpay from High School Musical, and the kids go, oh, you know that? I've got them on my side. I won them over. It's a powerful, powerful tool in the classroom. If I turn to those kids, like some teachers do, I hear them do this, like, I don't understand any of these characters you're talking about. Patrick, SpongeBob, what the heck is that? Wow, you just alienated 30 kids. You just made 30 kids realize that they shouldn't talk to you about things.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, the point is that the big idea is that I actually enjoy watching the stuff anyway. And yeah, you know what? These shows, Phineas and Ferb, what are some of the other new ones that are really popular with the kiddies?
Adventure Time.
I still have not seen Adventure Time, and I need to. I know,
man,
I need
funny.
To. That's what I keep hearing. My Little Pony. When I mention My Little Pony in a classroom full of kids, I win big, big points with them. They're like, wow, you're a grown up and you watch this. When I was teaching in Detroit, I remember one kid said to the teacher, I overheard this. This wasn't like directed at me. The kid's like, I think he likes Kim Possible more than I do. That was awesome to hear. And I was like, yeah, I bet I do, actually. But yeah, like this kind of territoriality of like my experience was the best experience, or my experience is the primary experience, and everybody else, that's like a defense mechanism that we put up to justify our choices. And this goes back to something Ryan Estrada said to me, and I know I quote him a lot, but he's a guy where every time I spend a little bit of time with him, he says like three words that stick with me for the rest of my life. And I don't think he's doing it on purpose. He's totally not being Yoda here. He's not being Fortune Cookie.
Well, he's like the Kane of comics, right? I mean, he's walking the earth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Making comics.
That's how I'm going to introduce him this week, and comics are great. but yeah, he just said, he's like, everybody's justifying their choices. Everybody's trying to come up with a reason why they are in the area that they are. And this accounts for part of like the cheerleading we do for ourselves on the social media. This accounts for why we will say, well, your cartoons, kids, are no good. In my day, we had such and such. Oh, wow. I see people talk like that who are our age, and that scares me. Like, dude, you really want that, the Lazy Boy? You want the Lazy Boy now? You know, we're in our early 30s.
I know. It's only going to get harder. You should get used to working at the adaptation. Yeah, that's tough to see. So,
yeah,
whatever.
Is.
If you're younger, you have that to look forward to.
Well, or not. You know, I mean, if like this is the whole thing.
As in your if people who don't share your perspective of adapting and learning or whatever, because it's hard to see. You care about people around you, and you know, maybe they're not adapting as much, and you're like, oh, that's a bummer.
Yeah, that's a bummer to see that.
But I mean, you're saying like the territory and justifying choices and all that stuff. really, I mean,
it's perfectly
ties back together.
It's a human way to be too. You know, I mean, that's the other thing. It's like, you know, you can't say that all these people are monsters for doing that. They're stupid for doing that. They deserve our dishonor or disrespect for doing that. They're just being human beings, and they're just trying their best too, like everybody. And I think that's the only thing that switched in my brain that prevents me from having an emotional crack up every time I see somebody doing something awesome is that.
What is a helpful thing? Like, I'm curious, like really curious. This is say I'm throwing a curveball, whatever, but when do you tune it out then? So when are like these new things coming along and you decide that, no, that's cool. I don't need it. when does it make sense to filter it out to say like, no, I'm not going to elect that as like a piece of learning material for me or fun or entertainment or whatever?
That's a tough one. That's a really tough one. Let me think about it for a second.
Sure.
You know, I think first of all, gut reaction is that I never fully let go of any of these things.
Mm-hmm.
If they're interesting enough, I'll capture them via some kind of notes thing,
yeah.
Or they'll just stay buried in my brain. I I have like a fairly decent memory for that kind of thing. I know I was referring earlier to a story that I couldn't quite quote directly, but that was me being a little bit cheeky in not wanting to name names.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the time these things will just stay there and they'll kind of come, they'll bubble back up to the surface and kind of go back down a little bit back and forth. So like they'll pop up and then like look at it again and say, is this useful? Nope, still not useful. How do I know it's not useful? Okay, this is where I get to say something lame and fruity. You know when you're centered. You know when you are on the beam and walking with confidence, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or when you're doing, and I don't mean like you know this in your front cortex kind of thing. I mean you have a general kind of like gut feeling of when you're doing, when you're operating out of that kind of center place, and when you're doing it because this is what the cool kids are doing, you know, mm-hmm. or this is what I should be doing. Dad says I should do this, and I want to do it right. You know, you have a sense of that. Maybe it's not always easy to hear that. It's not always easy to listen for that kind of gut reaction. But, you know, like, it's like, and I fall off the beam all the time. I was talking with a friend about plans I had for sugary cereals, and I started going into what my blogging strategy was going to be and what news agencies I was going to reach out to. And he said to me, dude, you do know that your first priority is to make a really good comic first, right? And I got kind of mad at the moment he said that, but then I thought about it and I was like, well, that's a good reminder. It's a good reminder that I can't put the cart before the horse on this, and I can't control who's going to read this thing. That's one of the glories and despairs of internet publishing, of publishing of any kind. Is you mm-hmm. don't really, you can promote, you can advertise, and you should. You can go to conventions and self-promote, you should. If you want to do this for any kind of like reasonable, if you want to get the word out about your work, if you want to be noticed, if you want an audience, whether or not you want to do it for a living, you should do those things. But ultimately, you don't know how that randomizing mechanism is going to activate. And so all you can do is operate out of that center. Operate. This goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning about emotions and emotional honesty. Is like you have to be honest emotionally with the work itself and with what you want out of the work and in the way you execute that work. That sounds so vague and so last chapter of a Seth Godin book, you know.
It's funny, as I hear you, obviously we try to avoid that territory, but we dance on the line of that territory constantly. Once in a while, you just got to jump into it. You just 2 feet, bam, here I am.
Yeah.
Touchy-feely land I
don't have any kind of thinking strategy. I don't have any okay. kind of like
I think you nailed it. Honestly, for me, someone who like one of the books I recently read which reminded me of some things about design, 100 Things Every Designer Must Know by Susan Weinschenk. She hits on, let's see, she terms three different sort of areas of the brain, a little bit with her own spin on it, because I think she calls it she doesn't say lizard brain for the old brain. She says old brain or something like that. But basically, okay. It's your emotional faculties, your rational faculties, and then your very primal ones. And that related to the topic
about being
somewhere.
Centered, about being
yeah about being centered, and the different, you're not always operating out of that really clear I know exactly what's going on zone, but you're operating out of your overall system of abilities to process that, maybe a little bit instinct and a little bit emotion. And
I want to back up 3 steps and I want to talk about that montage, because when I say something like, you know when you're operating out of a center, people are going to misconstrue that possibly to mean that I'm always operating out of the center. There's always a music montage going on and I'm always progressing steadily towards that goal. And, you know, all of a sudden that music, you're the best around, starts playing, whenever I'm working. And no, you know, there are days where it's a struggle to get back to that center. There are days where I know I'm not going to be back at that center. I had a day last week where Anne came to meet me after work. I just finished a class. And she says, how did it go? And I said, those kids beat the hell out of me. And I said, do you want a beer? Because I want a beer. And it turned into both of us just having a solid hour and a half over beers, just venting. Like, all the things you say, my talents are being wasted. I'm better than this. Oh, I'm hitting the microphone because I'm gesticulating.
Super gesticulating. Bonus. But,
you know, it's like I'm slamming the table with my fist. And it's like, I deserve better than this. I deserve a better life than what I'm getting. You know, all that stuff you do, all of that, New York Broadway play kind of screaming that you do when you're feeling that way. I wasn't in my center. I didn't mean those things. I was just shaken up. I was mad. I was burnt out and I had a rotten day. And the next day I tried to get back into that center again because there's always a tomorrow. And if there's not, you're dead. What difference does it make? That sounds like grandpa advice, but that's literally how I feel about it.
Yeah. It is funny how that worked. There is scarcity. It's not like we can't really summarize it where, you know, like, not that I'm forcing a summary or anything right now, but there is we're alive for a time and then we're not. So, there is that, but other than that, I mean, a lot of this other stuff, we just kind of make up because we're not necessarily able to fully grasp these crazy, incredible amounts of information in the details and stuff to somehow track. I mean, heck, we're just not good at doing that complex of thinking. I mean, creative or not. I mean, there's some things we're good at and some things we're not. We can figure out ways and workarounds through it. But, you know, for instance, look at the discipline of meteorology. It's really complex, really, really hard. And we're getting better with it probably over time, but it remains hard. And this is like looking at where we stand in the sea of humanity and everyone creating everything and whatnot. It's pretty darn complex also. And, obviously just, you know, finding a way to, you know, find your center, practice getting it out where, like, one thing we talked about when we mentioned this topic that I think it's worth, you know, grabbing and pulling in here real quick is the, what if you're doing this and that's all you're doing? Right. So it can be paralyzing. That's another reaction to all this is not just the frustration and the unfairness or feeling that, well, how did so-and-so get famous versus, you know, my efforts, right? What if it stops there and people aren't, you know, finishing, like, so their efforts really don't, and actually I say they, because I think I've mentioned, you know, I'll re-mention a brief version of the anecdote that I had worked on a personal game project of one sort or another for about 16 years. Yeah. 16. 1-6, yes. And then finally got Guitar Fretter out. I wasn't working on Guitar Fretter from day one, thankfully. But there was a process that I just needed to go through. And I had other reasons, some of overlap with this topic as far as, wow, look at this thing. This is amazing. Know what? I got to add this to my project. No, you know, look at, oh, wow. So-and-so did this. Now I actually have to table working on my project while I build up my business model and I don't know, publishing schedule or whatever to get to their level.
Yeah. So like what the question is like, what would I say to somebody who's stuck in that infinite cycle of constantly comparing and adding and beleaguering themselves by adding on to their.
Yeah. I guess, do you think that's a thing? The comparing, like one of the possible ways to get caught in this web is the comparing and adding and never finishing. And then also, so what do you do about that?
I'm gonna quote another 80s movie because the 80s was the best decade and everything that was created in the 80s is far superior to anything that anybody else ever experienced and ever will experience. If you didn't grow up in the 80s, you missed out. It was the golden era. and for somebody a little older than me, it was the 70s. the movie Better Off Dead with John Cusack. Mm-hmm. Yep. There's a line in there where, I mean, the premise of the film is about how he's endlessly depressed because the girl who he is crazy about is dating some mean jock. And he can never get her back. And so he's concocting constant, all these elaborate ways to kill himself, like, you know, covering himself in propane or something like that, and then light himself on fire. He tries to kill himself in the car by plugging the exhaust or whatever, or like locking the garage door and like running the car, all kinds of things. But it's a very silly, rompy kind of film, right?
Sure. Black comedy, probably, like, you know, dark humor. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, because a woman's face gets blown up at one point. and then she shows up with like a face cast later on.
Okay.
It's a very strange movie, and I'm not going to say it's a great movie, but it's an 80s movie. At one point in the story, this French exchange student who becomes the romantic interest for John Cusack says, "I think if you get a little taste of success, you'll find that it suits you." And she provides him with an achievable goal, which is to fix his some old car, some 60s car. I think it's a Camaro or something like that. And then they do it. And they did it in the montage where they're the music's playing and they get a little oil on their nose and they're laughing. they take out all the hard work that went into that. But it was a goal with a beginning, middle, and end. And this is something I think about a lot, too. And this is with my students, why I try to encourage them when they're just starting out to do mini comics, because it's an achievable goal. And when they get a taste of success of finishing a small thing, then doing another one, and then doing another one, they're going to find out that that feeling of success is suitable to most people. And it will help. It's helped me, at any rate, keep out of that endless funk of things and to realize that every project is the lead into another project. And so as not to get forced into that tunnel of this endless, endless, endless project. And I got to keep rejiggering it, keep reinventing it. Well, why not take on a few little things? If what this guy is doing is so compelling, or what this gal is doing is so compelling, and you got to do a little bit of that in your own work, do a mini thing with it. Do a mini project. Play with it, you know, and engage with it in the spirit of play as best you can. And try not to have that clock ticking of I gotta do it. If I don't meet this race at the game of life, then I lose, and then the floor drops out from under me, and everybody laughs.
Yeah. Well, I wish I would have talked with you a lot sooner.
Why?
No, I don't know. But what's funny is you're right. That's what I eventually ended up doing.
Was that a joke about the life schedule?
Yeah, no, the life schedule thing. That's a really, really good advice. I think it is approachable. I mean, it may seem like you're putting your big passionate thing at risk, but it's, you probably would be doing that project a big favor by.
I'm not a psychologist, and I don't even have a certified teaching degree. So I am not qualified to talk about this subject at all. But my suspicion is, so I'm going to talk about it anyway, because it's a podcast, and that's what podcasts are for, is for crackpots to share their half-baked ideas with the rest of the world as if it's advice. maybe this is one we should have done video with, because people need to see my expressions when I'm doing this to see that I'm kind of joking around.
This is right. And you are really animated this time. So yeah. Extra animated.
My suspicion is that this kind of endless cycle of self-comparison and the poisonous aspect of it comes out of a sense that you somehow believe that you can't achieve, that you're feeding into that doubt that you can't pull something off. And if you're in the middle of a long, complicated project and you're facing that, ooh, that's tough, because all you can do is go back and look at what you've accomplished so far. And if you have at least a few little things that are easily achieved, and I don't mean easy as in lazy, I mean easy as in it takes a limited amount of time and a limited amount of resources that you can afford to put into it, then the payoff is much more significant. It's greater than the sum of its parts, in the sense that you now have a series of little things that you can go back and say, okay, well, if all I've got is what I've done so far, if that's what makes me up, then at least I got these things to lay on top of the unfinished thing that I can't share with anybody. You know, that's all I can say is that that's what's worked for me. And I don't know if that's going to work for anybody else. So don't anybody come back to me with a lawsuit saying, hey, you said this was going to make me happy. It didn't make me happy, because I didn't guarantee that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, this isn't prescriptive. We are discussing and chewing on a challenging problem that we are familiar with. And I would say that, it's up to you to choose, you know, who do you listen to? What do you compare yourself against, and whatever? yeah, if you think we have something valid to say, it's still up to you how you apply it and whatnot. You know, is Jersey qualified to be a teacher? I'd say he's rather qualified.
Don't ask the people with the red tape, though.
Everyone's got to make that call on their own.
Yep. All right. Well, it feels like we've got somewhere. At least we walked around the park. And I think we saw all the different birch and beech and oak and maple. So.
Yep.
So 30 classes in 30 days. People should check it out.
Still going on. We are almost halfway through it as we record this.
Oh, my God.
Can you believe it?
Oh, my gosh. This year is going so fast.
I know. I mean, this was, Lean Into Art didn't even exist until this year and was a big quiet project that we worked on and built up and tried different versions of, like, how could we, what kind of experience do we want to build when or whatever? And then conceived 30 classes and did a bunch of stuff to make sure we could pull it off. And then there you go. And all of a sudden, I announced it, got some students.
Yeah.
We're already, and then it's halfway done already. Ugh. And that's a crazy way to summarize the year. A lot of other stuff we did too. But
and that goes back to achievable, like doing achievable things that are short term, right? It's like when we're done with 30 classes in 30 days, we're going to have 30 classes that we helped bring about.
And
there's the proof that we can do it. So now we can do it on a much more relaxed scale, a couple classes a month.
Exactly.
Unless the demand is there. If the demand is there, we can do it again. But
I think we'd set it up where we'd take weekends off or something too. Or have some days off.
That'd be kind of cool. Like I got a couple days off from the project, but it was because I was so darn sick.
Well, right. And I had a couple days off because there was a big event that I'd, artists from out of town coming in and all that stuff. And
but for all intents and purposes, we're thinking about this like a good portion of every workday.
It's a really cool test. I mean, we built this. This is like the thing we reshaped as we lived this out, the whole like defining a big thing and what do you wish for and compare ourselves to a bunch of stuff, drafted it, started working on it, realized that version of the vision had to be revised, came up with a new one, which is, it's big and it's definitely challenging, but we knew that we could accomplish it, because it's really built of a whole bunch of small things.
Yeah.
All the separate classes and whatnot. And it's going well. I feel really good about the classes we've recorded and the overall flow of it, how we kicked it off with a like a fun theme of a keynote.
Yeah.
That because of certain wildlife adventures, I actually was in the same place as Jersey when we did that. And that's all going on in the midst of this big event. And the
craziest part of that was how you were just like in town for like a couple hours. It was like, all right, I'm here. Let's go down. Let's do the keynote. All right. Well, then we'll have a beer. We'll toast each other for getting the thing started. All right. I got to go. See you later. It's like all it needed was like the helicopter with a rope dropped down in my front lawn. And then you just grab onto it and just say like, off we go. And then it flies you away.
It's pretty much how it went. It's wild, but we're doing it. And so not just to throw out, generic, feel good, rainbows, stars, ponies, whatever. It's neat look, the experience of a class, it's like, Jersey or I plus an instructor will log into Adobe Connect plus the students will join in and we'll make sure everything's running smooth, introduce the instructor. And then all of a sudden, a sweet class occurs and it's involved with both presenting of some helpful material. I mean, basically these are road and life experience, creative practitioner tested things that they've bundled up and are sharing in like roughly 1 to 2 hour chunks. And then a couple of our classes are actually multi-sessioned, right? So a few of them are beyond that, but they're delivered in those 1 to 2 hour chunks. And students are interacting along the way, and then we get the Q&A at the end. And it's a really rich environment, considering we just wander to our computers and then we all sort of just do this from wherever we're at throughout the entire world. And that's for the students that participate live. And then we go through our you know, we download it and process and re-upload. And for the rest of the students that have the time shifted experience, then they download it. And all of a sudden we'll hear from them in the forums or on Twitter. And it's been cool.
We coined the term, or rather the term was coined for us recently, is that it's a learning network. It's not about necessarily a product or a thing that you're actually getting, a physical thing. Like, there's the 12 CD set. It's about an experience, and it's about a safe network of people who are all interested in learning the same kinds of things, not even in the same ways. There are people who are more private. There are people who are more reserved. There are people who are more outgoing, people who want to share more. But in any case, it's a place where you can feel safe to engage with content like what we talk about in Lean Into Art. So, hey, check this out. Just out of curiosity, I went to Google Plus while you're talking.
Yeah.
Creating, using, and promoting Google Plus pages properly. This post. 150 shares, 61 plus ones, 25 comments. See? That goes back to what we were talking about earlier. This prescriptive stuff, it works every time. And then it invites you to go, am I using it properly? Way. Am I doing it right? I
don't know. Yeah.
I mean, and you know what? I'm betting there's a lot of interesting content in this slide deck that this guy put on his site. I'm not making fun of the guy. I'm not making fun of teaching. But, man, you lead with a headline like that. People respond. So if you are looking for the secret sauce, everybody, there it is. Just say the 5 easy steps to do such and such, the 10 easy things to do such and such, the right way to do such and such. You'll get attention. or you'll get people mad at you.
Yeah. Well, we are well tuned.
I didn't mean to backtrack, but I just saw it and I had to sit.
No, there. You know what? This is I'm jumping into this one. So let's see. The Industrial Revolution happened. And I think that's pretty badass. Like, humanity, we changed the face of the planet in a pretty rapid time frame to mixed degree, right? So we made affordances where we can feed more people, we can live in mass in different ways that we didn't have that before. Humans are tough and awesome. We can do so much. But and to be able to pull that off, it didn't take just one generation. So we had to find a way to teach people and express ideas in a way that fit with that system. And what we're doing at Lean Into Art, I believe, fits very well with that system. I would argue my career is like a weird beta test of these ideas. Like, how in the world did I work in the corporate world and still do from time to time whatever? Because different ideas, different kinds of thinking really can work well together. There is that the common model that you run into, though, I would argue, because of things that are pretty darn definitive to quite a few lifetimes of recent generations, is this approach where, like, there is an official way. There is always this.
This tutorial is called the ultimate tutorial.
Ay-yi-yi. How am I not reading that right now? Stop recording.
It's like everything about it is just calculated to play on that lizard brain, isn't it?
It is, exactly. And so, but you know, when you learn that and you realize, oh, okay, they're expressing this in a way to cause a reaction in me.
Yep.
I don't have to react or whatever.
Right.
And I can choose. And so we have that puzzle as far as marketing our classes at Lean Into Art. How do we do this in a way that we do want to reach people? We want to have a large audience, but of course, we also don't want to misrepresent our intentions and say that, well, now, guess what? All those simple primitives that observe this other practice, I mean, they are silly. We've got the steam engine, right?
Yeah.
The radical, incredible, first time ever, you know, boost your productivity, magic, production line, blah, 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 whatever, steam engine thing. I don't know. I think we have something pretty awesome, but we're not going to try to fool you into using it. And I hope your lizard brain gets tickled once in a while from what we do, because that'd be fun, I guess, right? Yeah. But do something thrilling. But
actually, I haven't gotten a hate mail in a long time, and it's starting to worry me. It's making me worry that maybe what I'm doing is too bland and too too reserved, too thoughtful. No, seriously. I mean, I used to, like, there was a year there when I was doing the Art and Story Cast where, man, it was like, it was every couple months or so somebody would say something really bad about me. And while it hurt my feelings, I also realized that, you know, if you're ticking people off, you're probably onto something.
That is one, that's one kind of feedback. A fist coming at you is a kind of feedback.
Yeah.
But it's, there's other kinds of feedback too. And I think what we found is that there, that we're doing something different. So I love Art and Story. I would not know you, Jersey, if it weren't for Art and Story. And, I mean, I very much miss it and I highly respect it, but I do think we have a different community.
Yeah, that's true. That's totally true.
Yeah, I mean, you started a different band, and we don't play exactly the same kind of music, so...
Now we're into progressive rock now.
Yep.
We're into that impenetrable 45-minute long songs where everybody gets a solo.
Oof. Maybe that's what it is, where I was like, yeah, I'm going to pull in this topic. It was my gut saying, you know, it's time to solo, Rob. You didn't get your solo quota in. So, whatever. I basically have a different kind of, not that Art and Story was definitely a 21st century kind of thing, where, I mean, even said that phrase is getting a bit old too, where it's like, We're talking about learning through experience and empowering, and we share a communication back and forth. It's a learning network between the teachers and the students, and the students and the students, and the teachers and the mm-hmm. teachers, and we're all connected and making it an experience where it's to benefit us. And it's not just the Industrial Revolution. Here's not to lose how to lose a hand when you're on the production line, you know, making sure the soup can has a top on it or whatever.
Right.
But it'll hopefully help with leveling up regarding creative efforts. Mm-hmm. So yeah. There you go.
So cool. I think that was a satisfactory advertisement for what we're doing at Lean Into Art.
Yeah.
I think so. I think you summarized it well. And I was making fun of that guy's, you know, slide deck of Google Plus pages properly used. I totally respect people using that methodology to get attention to it, right? Like I said, for all I know, there's a lot of really, really great content in there. I'm actually going to read it later when I have some time.
It works.
But you have to recognize that you just have to be aware of what is carnival barking and what is, it's like goes back to like the whole sexy headline thing, right? Mm-hmm. Which is the headline you're going to lead with to get people to go, So there you go. Not, don't want to sound like I'm dismissing somebody else's pedagogical style, right?
It's tough. When you try to be inclusive and respect everyone, we always calm down and we say, hey, but we listen to it and we think about it anyway, and we try to be nice.
Yeah.
But I don't pull it off every day. Yeah. I think they suck, Jersey.
Rob's ultimate guide to what sucks and doesn't suck will be available at leanintoart.com.
No, it's not Rob's. It's the.
Oh, the. Sorry. Yeah, see.
The ultimate.
I screwed up.
Allow me to totally flush everything I just said the last few minutes.
Oh, man. This is a good one. I feel good about it. So
awesome.
Okay. Then what we'll say is thanks, everybody, for downloading and listening. More stuff coming up in the outro piece that you're about to hear. But what's not in there is that I'm Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I am Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
And this also isn't in there. Okay.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.